Hello and welcome to the Josh Holiday Podcast for the 18th of April 2010. It's gorgeous outside. I'm inside doing a podcast, and I'm going to do something a little different this week. I'm just going to fly by the seat of my pants. Most of the previous episodes I've done, I spent a lot of time writing stuff out and blah, 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 blah. This time, going a little bit more point form and just going to go with the flow, see what happens. This weekend, yesterday was terrible weather, and I thought it was going to be terrible weather for both days of the weekend. So yesterday I was out and about and doing all kinds of stuff, thinking that, okay, I'll do my inside stuff, my cleaning and organizing inside stuff today. And then, of course, it's amazing outside, so my apartment will go unclean for another week unless I can force myself during the week to actually accomplish something around the house after work. We will see. It's also tricky, though, because I'm spending an inordinate amount of time watching the NHL playoffs. The Leafs are out. My team is out. And initially, my thought was, well, I guess it's not so bad because I can actually get outside and actually do some stuff. But the quality of the hockey is so good, and all the series seem to be pretty awesome, that from the time you get home in the evening till way late in the evening, there's always some really great hockey on. So it's tempting to just kind of sit and watch hours on end of hockey. So I think my solution is to choose a couple of series that I really watch, and then others if I happen to be flipping around. I like the Philadelphia New Jersey series, mostly because there's some animosity. The Ottawa Penguin series, also kind of fun. As a Leafs fan, I hate Ottawa. You just have to if you're a Leafs fan. It's part of being a Leafs fan. But I will say that I'm having less of a hard time kind of cheering them on, because there are players on there that I don't like because they're in Ottawa, but I would have liked if they had played for Toronto. Like over the summer, Chris Neal was going to be a free agent. And there was speculation Toronto might jump on that. And I thought, he's for them, he's, I hate the guy and like when he gets his ass handed to him and fights and stuff. But I like the style of play, and I think in a Toronto uniform, I'd be right behind him. I think sort of like Dion Phaneuf. That was the one reason I could never really get behind the Calgary Flames, and I talked about this in an earlier podcast, and that's because I was living in Calgary. Toronto was always my team, but I went out there for a radio gig for a couple years, and you would hear stories about his behavior off the ice and sort of prima donna stuff and kind of douchey behavior. So I thought, oh God, now he's coming to Toronto. But I also speculated at the time that maybe this is a chance for him to kind of start with a clean slate and get rid of that baggage. And he's still a pretty young guy, so I think it's part of becoming mature. And now with these playing for the Leafs, I'm actually pretty happy. I think he's doing a good job, and I haven't heard any stories yet, so maybe that's what he needed. Maybe he needed a change of scenery. In any case, those series I like. I'm a fan of Alexander Ovechkin. I think he's one of he's the most dynamic, interesting. He's the star in the league right now. Say what you will about Crosby and Ovechkin. In terms of playing talent, they're pretty close. But in terms of pure entertainment value, there's no one in the league better than Alexander Ovechkin. He's a classic power forward with incredible skill. He does it all. I was a little worried in the first game that he wasn't having the great game, and then through the Olympics too, he didn't seem to shine. But I think when he gets into his physical game, he picks it up and he plays well. So the hockey playoffs are keeping me inside too much. I think that's what I'm trying to say. But that's that. And maybe next year the Leafs will be in the playoffs. We'll wait and see. I mentioned the nice weather and walking around outside. The one thing I've talked about this even in Calgary, but just in general, I consider myself fairly socially liberal, but one thing I'm getting a little more hardened to is panhandling. And I think this is true of most major cities, but I've definitely noticed it here in Toronto. And it's not recently that I've noticed it, but it seems to be growing every year. I live in the Annex, which is a pretty busy downtown neighborhood, and it's along Bloor Street, one of the busier streets in Toronto. And I would say in three or four blocks, you could probably run into, just on the one side of the street, maybe, 10 panhandlers. It's a lot. And sometimes it's tied in with the homeless thing, but sometimes the panhandlers, I think it's not because they're homeless. It's because maybe they have a drug problem or there's some mental issues there as well. And I one example I point to, and it sort of changed my mind a little bit and opened my eyes a little bit, is watching Intervention. And the one guy who was a panhandler seemed very charming out in front of stores, hard on his luck, but he would take the money, go and get some injectables, and that was what he did with the money. And I think, people want to give money to panhandlers because it eases, I guess, their guilt of living a comfortable life, but it's not the right thing to do. You're encouraging bad behavior. You're saying, oh, you're here doing something that we don't really want you to do, and you're sort of, it's bad behavior. Here's some money. Keep doing it, please. Here, I'm going to pay you to continue this bad behavior. I've compared this before, but there's signs by the river out in Calgary that say, don't feed the ducks because they'll become reliant on your food, and then when winter comes, it'll cause them harm. You're encouraging bad behavior, basically. Are there problems with the social services net here in Toronto? And I'm guessing in other cities? Yeah, of course. But I don't know. I've more and more, I'm leaning towards a plan that would outlaw panhandling. If you make it illegal, you will force these people to find other means of support, and hopefully that's social programs. And instead of handing money to panhandlers, not knowing what the panhandlers are going to do with the money that they've donated, the people will maybe donate to actual legitimate causes that make sure the money gets spent on food and shelter and mental health and housing. I guess it's the same thing as shelter, right? I do find it frustrating. And then there's the issue of, like, today I was walking along Bloor, and there's a big bench in front of one of the stores, and there's some guys, it's like around lunchtime, just maybe hungover, I don't know, crashed out the full length of the bench. I thought, wow, you're really seeing the decay of a city here in front of your eyes. And I think, I don't have all the answers, but I think there's got to be some solution to at least making it uncomfortable to panhandle, to just kind of lie around in the city streets. Every day on the way to work, too, there's a guy. And I don't want to come across as a cold-hearted, unfeeling guy, because I certainly have some sympathy, but there's got to be a different way. And I think that, most of it deals with panhandling and the fact that people panhandle knowing that they will get money. And there's some people, and this is a very, very small percentage. I don't want to paint everyone as like trying to be a scammer, but there's some people who panhandle as a living, and it, and they do quite well. There used to be this girl. I worked at 102.1 The Edge, and the studios were down at Yonge and Dundas. And for many years, there was a girl there who would try and sell stickers. She'd be like, "Oh, here, who's the smiley gentleman? You want to buy a sticker?" And she sometimes would have a rap where she'd say, "Oh, the money, I'm raising money for Casey House. If you give me some money, I'll give you a little sticker." And as it turns out, she had a crack baby, and she looked very presentable, like she could be representing a charitable organization. But as it turns out, she wasn't. And I would see her all the day kind of walking on the street, smiling and getting people to pay for stickers. And these people thinking, "Oh, I'm giving to an actual good cause. Here's a representative of a good cause." Meanwhile, the money was going towards her and her condo. And again, it's a small percentage of people, but the fact is that when you give money to someone random on the street, you have no idea where that money's going. In your head, I suppose, with this guilt, like, "Oh, this poor person," you maybe hope or assume that, okay, they're going to go and get a meal or find a place to sleep tonight. But in many, many, many cases, that's not what happens. That money is used for alcohol, cigarettes, and drugs. That's what happens. And so I think because people will continue to give money to panhandlers, we've got to do something about maybe banning panhandling and forcing these panhandlers to seek help elsewhere instead of panhandling. And the same thing with homeless on the streets. And again, this comes down to not enough resources for mental health and for housing. So maybe some of my thoughts are kind of utopian, but I think, you know, if there's people lying around the streets, you say, you know, you can't do that. If you're going to lie around the street, we're going to take you either to a shelter or we're going to get you some mental health help, but you can't lay around on the streets. You have to be either in a shelter or out of sight. And again, that's an ideal world, and I don't have all the answers. And of course, there's, you know, contrary viewpoints where it's like, well, you know, it's not their fault, and it isn't really in a lot of cases. A lot of times, it is addiction or mental health issues, and sometimes a combination of both that drives people to the streets. And it's definitely not an easy black and white area. So yeah, so there's my cleaning up the streets. And while we're on the topic of the streets, another thing that really irks me, and I don't know, I think I've seen an evolution of it. I used to think Toronto was a really beautifully clean city, and people were very respectful of the city and would always, you know, not just throw stuff on the streets randomly. But I'm finding more and more over the years that there's a culture of, that's not my problem, someone else will tidy up after me. I'll walk along and finish my whatever I'm eating or something, just throw the wrapper on the ground. Someone else will tidy up after me. There's a culture of maybe entitlement or a me first kind of attitude where it's like, I'm whatever, I'm me, someone else will take care of it. It's really, really frustrating. And another tied to that issue, I guess, is smokers who have been forced out of restaurants, which is a good thing. I still wish that they weren't allowed to smoke on patios, because basically it forces people who don't enjoy smoke with their meal to avoid the patio. So it almost rewards the smokers in the nice weather. It's like, oh, yeah, you get to hang out in the cool area where it's all sunny and nice, and yeah, you can pollute people's meals with a smoke. That's a whole other issue. But the issue of smokers just throwing their butts everywhere really, really irks me. And it's weird how there's a double standard for that. You know, a smoker might see someone like eat a chocolate bar and throw their wrapper on the ground and be like, look at this person, they just littered. Yet, you know, a minute later, they'll flick their cigarette out on the street or on the sidewalk or wherever it suits them. And I think we have to change our attitude towards that, both non-smokers and smokers, that, yeah, that's you're throwing litter on the ground. Every time you smoke and throw a cigarette on the ground, you are littering. You're dirting up the city. And for whatever reason, people have turned a blind eye to this. I mean, I don't think everybody has. Certainly I haven't. But smokers, and there seems to be an exception to the rule of, like, well, that's not litter, it's a cigarette. And I do understand that there's not enough receptacles for your smoking habit. It's an addiction, and people are addicted, and they're going to do it. But with that comes a responsibility. If you're going to smoke, then take care of your mess. Tidy it up. Don't just throw your cigarette butts willy-nilly everywhere you can. Look for a receptacle. If you're really conscious about not being a douchebag, butt out your cigarette on a wall or something, and then put it in a tin box or something. Whatever you have to do outside of throwing your cigarette on the ground. And the other thing I find kind of outrageous is people who smoke in their cars. They have ashtrays in their cars, But instead of using the ashtray, well, I don't want to get my car smoky or put, have ash in my car, just flick their butts out the window. You've made a choice to smoke. You've got an addiction. Deal with it responsibly. Don't throw your butt out the window. And on another note, in the dry season, there's many examples of fires and damage that's been done from lit cigarettes being thrown out of cars and causing a tremendous amount of damage. It's just really, I mean, it's a filthy habit. And I find it hard to sort of fathom. I know it is an addiction. I know it's hard to break. And sometimes I think of stuff that I do on a regular basis that, oh, if I had to give that up, it'd be tough. But if you're going to do it, then take some responsibility. Don't have this me-first attitude like, well, I don't give a shit. I'm going to smoke and throw it wherever I want. It's just a really, really poor way of thinking. And the same thing with, while we're on the topic of smoking, doorways. It's like, fuck, you're choosing this thing. And in the winter here in Toronto, it does get cold, so people tend to hover around near the front doorways rather than way out in the cold. But I'm sorry, you've made a choice. Deal with it responsibly. Go where I can't smell your smoke, or I don't have to walk through, you know, a tunnel of smoke on the way into my workplace or somewhere I need to be. So there, that's that. Changing topics here, by the way. I don't know if you need a segue. Speaking of smoke and ash, how about that volcano in Iceland? If I was a man of segues, that's probably the cheesy segue I would have used to get to the topic of the volcano. It's an amazing phenomena. And I don't just mean like a natural phenomenon. Oh, look, amazing. It's a volcano. That is amazing. Yeah, the volcanoes are pretty cool and pretty amazing. And Mother Nature is pretty amazing. But I think socially and economically and just generally, I don't even know what word I'm looking for. But the fact that basically this volcano has shut down air traffic throughout most of Europe, which also means getting in from other countries, from North America, getting in and out of Europe, and people from Europe getting back to North America, really got me thinking of how much we take for granted how easily it is to travel, how we've taken for granted how air travel has changed things so dramatically. I mean, it wasn't that long ago in terms of history. It's just a blip on history where there wasn't air travel, and you know, the furthest people could get, most people, you know, you had your explorers on ships and I guess vehicles eventually. It really boggles how, you know, back then, you know, you're probably, the range of your travel would be, you know, in thousands of miles or kilometers, whichever you prefer. But now you can fly anywhere you want, and in within less than a day, you could pretty much be anywhere in the world. It's pretty amazing when you think about it, and we don't really until something like this happens where there's a natural phenomenon that's happened, and the problem is that the ash that's coming out of this volcano is very sharp, and if planes fly, it can seize up the engine. So it's really dangerous to fly. So pretty much everything is grounded in Europe. And I started thinking about all the scenarios, all the stories that people have. Like I was in Greece and Turkey for three or four weeks in September and October. And I was just thinking about, well, what if that volcano had fired off towards the end of our trip there? What would we have done for an extra, how, you know, right now it's indefinite. It seems like at least 2 weeks of stagnant air travel. You know, you think of people who are sort of stranded over there, you know, some people who you know, take a week or two off their jobs and they have very important things to do over here, and just how it is sort of like the butterfly effect where that one person can't do that, and then it's spread, you know, the fact that everything shut down. And of course, you know, the main focus is the economic factors where international trade has come to you know, grinding halt for those European countries. You know, a lot of them depend on shipping stuff out, and it's not happening. And there's a lot of international business, and you look at the funeral of the Polish Prime Minister, and not that that's, you know, bring things to a grinding halt, but the fact that Harper and Obama can't go to the funeral because they just can't travel in the air, and I just imagine all the people who are sort of stranded either here who need to go back to Europe or in Europe who need to come home. And I imagine there's tons of stories of stranded vacationers, stranded businessmen, and just what they have to do to cope with this unfortunate circumstance. And it really got me thinking about how much we take for granted the fact that we can travel anywhere, pretty any time, you know, for what really isn't a lot of money, really. You know, you think about it. You can pay, you know, $500 and be in London tomorrow. When you think about it, it's pretty amazing. And it's just hard to sort of get your head around the fact that in Europe, most of Europe, every airport is shut down. There's no flights in or out. I remember in you know, a post 9/11, there wasn't a lot of flight activity for a few days, and that seemed like a pretty big deal. And it seemed to be restricted to North America. I mean, I think flights to and from Europe to North America were affected, but in this case, it's basically separating continents. I mean, there's a huge amount of people in the European nations, and they are isolated right now from the rest of the world, and it's really scary because there's no real idea of when things will get back to normal. Is, you know, as of today, the volcano is still spewing. That sounds dirty, but it is, and so it's not like, okay, well, you're going to be here for 2 weeks. It's like, well, we don't know how long you're going to be here. And then there's the domino effect where people who need to get home on one day, then they can't get home, so it gets backed up. So imagine once flights start going out again, it's going to be a tremendous backlog of people that need to get to places. And it also affects shipping, you know, your FedExes and your international shipping and product. It's just really, really a huge thing that's hard to get your head around. It really makes me think about how we've taken for granted the fact that this planet has become such a small place in terms of getting to and fro, and it kind of takes us back a bit, and you step back and think, wow, this, what would happen, you know, if all of a sudden you couldn't travel by air anymore. Oh, yeah, so there. What else did I want to talk about? Oh, I just a little bit. I just wanted to touch on I'm constantly amazed, and I talked about this in, I think it was my last podcast, about the different mindset of conservative people, and more so in the States, of what you would describe as conservative and liberals, and how conservatives tend to be very sort of almost stubborn, sort of set in their ways, and they need to be told how to think. They're not really people who ask a lot of questions. They just want someone to tell them, okay, this is what is happening, this is what's going on. Whereas liberals tend to be more, and I'm generalizing, of course, tend to be more inquisitive, more. Well, what's happening here? I want to hear points of view, and then I'll make a decision. And you're seeing this come to a head more and more in the States, where these Tea Party people, and the best thing that happens is when people will go to a Tea Party and ask some of the people there, so why are you protesting? What are you doing here? What are you against? What do you think of the thing? And they have no idea. They're just there because they think, oh, well, Glenn Beck or Sean Hannity told me that this is not good. Most of the people, I think 90% of the people in the U.S. are seeing a decrease in taxes, yet they're protesting increased taxes. It's just baffles the mind. And there's one anecdote where there's a woman who had driven, I think it was like 7 or 8 hours to a tea party with her seven kids in tow. And someone asked her, I think, man, it might have been Boston Globe, but they asked her, well, you know, what are you protesting? What are you protesting? She goes, well, she was protesting the health care. I don't think people should get health. Everyone should be covered by health care, taking away my health care to give it. And then the reporter asked, well, you know, how do you take care of your kids? And as it turns out, these are her seven homeschool kids. She depended on Medicaid, which is not Medicare, which is different from the old age thing. So she depends on this system for her kids, yet she's protesting against it. And I believe the reason she gave is, well, they're precious. So her kids are super special, and they're, you know, her kids, because they're hers, are special, but no one else should get this special thing. And you look at the tea parties, and it's just like, what? A lot of really just dumb people. And the scary thing is, once in a while, they're educated, but dumb. Which is, it's possible. You see, people, they've gone to college or whatever, but for whatever reason, they just need to be told what to think, and they think, oh, Glenn Beck, he's telling it like it is, and the great misnomer that Fox News is fair and balanced. I mean, that is, when you think about that, that's hilarious. It's sort of like the Bush administration talking about Operation Iraqi Freedom. No, you're not there to free the Iraqs. And they used to label all kinds of programs in the Bush administration with titles that were the opposite of what they were. Operation Clear Skies, I think that was their pollution thing. It was the opposite. It'll have more pollution. People, I don't know how people get so easily bamboozled. I think it's just a different way of thinking. People are wired different ways. And sometimes it's how they were brought up. It's just, well, my father told me that this was bad, blah, 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 blah. But it's certainly frightening to watch in the States. And here, you know, I could go on about Harper, but we'll leave that for another week. I wanted to touch upon changing subjects here, just for those of you who need a signal that we're changing subjects. I don't have a segue for this one. It's been a few weeks now. I'm going to talk about Eric Tunney, and I've posted this on my website, and it was on a Sunday a few weeks ago, and the news trickled out on Twitter, and then there was some speculation that it happened, and finally it was confirmed that Eric Tunney, at the age of 46, had passed away at his home in Windsor. And if you're not familiar with Eric Tunney, and I imagine if you're listening to this and you're not in Toronto or Los Angeles or part of the comedy scene, you might be a little out of the loop in terms of Eric Tunney, but it's definitely an interesting story and sort of a tragic one as well. When I started doing amateur stand-up comedy, there's a whole group of us sort of in the mid-90s at the Laugh Resort when it was on Lombard Street, just down from the Second City. So Victoria and Lombard, just a little west of Jarvis. And Eric Tunney used to perform there all the time, and his style was, he was very old school. He sort of had a madman air about him. He had a cigar and sort of the slick back, slightly pompadoured hair, and just a classic figure on the comedy scene. He was always one of my favorites. I would, at every opportunity, whenever he was I knew he was performing there, I would go and watch him, even though I'd seen him, you know, tons of times and doing the same material, which, you know, I don't think it's a huge secret that a lot of comedians, you know, every time you go on the stage, it's not a brand new set. You know, you work and hone your same set. And he had a lot of stuff, but there was repetition. But I would always go and see him and laugh every time, because I think his personality and his delivery and his attitude kind of transcended the actual material. And you laughed at the delivery. The writing was great, but just the way he delivered it was great as well. And he was just such a presence. And at the time, he was doing quite well. I remember sort of idolized him, to be quite honest, because he sort of had ambitions. A lot of comedians, their ambition is, oh, you know, I want to get on a sitcom or that type of thing. But Eric sort of wanted his goal was to host a talk show, and he was sort of, I think, so ideally suited to it, both in character and sort of just his way of being. He, as a comedian, of course, but also as a person who seemed genuinely curious and interested about the things happening around him, and with a unique take on those issues and everyday things as well. So that was in the sort of the mid-90s, and at the time I was doing comedy reporting for a radio station here in Toronto, and I would have Eric on. Anytime he was doing a feature show, I would have him on just to chat, and it was just fun. He was sort of a regular, and I got to know him fairly well back in those days, and I just really, really liked what he was doing, and I went to go see a talk show pilot that he was shooting, and it was really good, and you know, he was someone who everyone kind of thought, okay, this guy's, that's what he's going to do. He'll host a talk show, and he'll be great at it, and to give you an idea of, you know, where he was coming from, his potential, it was right around that time where he was chosen. I think there was only five people chosen for the HBO Young Comedian Special, which at the time was, and might still be a little bit, but I remember back at the time that was a pretty big honor to be one of the few selected for the yearly Young Comic Special, because it's sort of like, these are the cream of the upcoming crop. And he was on a show with Louis C.K., brilliant stand-up comedian, Dave Attell, also a very, very funny guy, Dave Chappelle, and it was hosted by Gary Shandling. I can't remember the other dude, the dude who went on to do sitcoms and stuff, but just a pretty fantastic, pretty amazing group of young comedians. So he was what you would call a rising star, and it was quite amazing, and this gets said about people, oh, you know, he had no enemies, but I think with Eric, he really, really didn't. He was, I think everybody genuinely liked him and liked being in his company, and I've never in all my time being around him or knowing of him heard anyone say a bad word about Eric Tunney. So that was great, and in the late 90s, he went to Los Angeles, which I guess is the natural progression for someone on that path, and he guest hosted a couple of nights on I believe is the later show, the one that Bob Costas was hosting, and then they had guest hosts for a while, and he did a great job, but that, you know, they had a rotating kind of guest host cast, and then my memory is a little bit foggy on what eventually happened with that, but so he was doing well, and then I think he co-hosted for a few months a morning television show in Los Angeles. And so he was having a modicum of success. And I stayed in touch a little bit. You know, I talked to him once in a while when he was in L.A. and then eventually fell out of touch for quite a few years. Cut to last year, about a year and a couple months ago, I was in Washington, D.C. I was house sitting, and I saw on Facebook, oh, Eric Tunney's performing in Toronto. I was like, wow, Eric's back. I hadn't heard from him in a long time. I hadn't heard what he was up to, and I was kind of down there. I was like, oh no, I'm stuck down here. This was the show I would love to see. And I, you know, all my friends in Toronto, I'd say, oh, make sure you go to this show, and that was that. And I sort of tried to get it, you know, other comics who kind of knew him or were related at that time, I said, oh, do you have contact info for Eric? I really wanted to reconnect, but for whatever reason, it wasn't successful. I couldn't, you know, it just didn't happen. So that was about a year and a couple of months ago. I cut to a couple of weeks ago, and it's a Sunday, and out of the blue, there's a tweet or a Facebook post saying, oh, we'll miss you, Eric, or Tunney, or rest in peace, Eric Tunney. And there was a groundswell, and eventually, you know, more news started coming out. And as it turns out, he was in Windsor, and I got the news. I guess I was sort of in touch with, I think she found out secondhand, but his manager, Karen, who for many years had sort of shepherded his career, and that they were really, really close, she confirmed for me that Eric had passed, and it was pretty shocking. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, God, really? And I hadn't really heard much about what had happened. And then word came that, you know, he'd had his longtime girlfriend, a real sweetheart, Ellen, they had sort of drifted apart. They were married, and I think they broke up. And he left Los Angeles, was having a little trouble money-wise, and went to a memorial-type thing where a bunch of comics were there and stuff, and got more background. There were some great stories about, I mean, road trips with Eric and people who really, really loved him. And everyone there had a great story about Eric. And news came out that, okay, well, you know, he had gone, you know, money-wise, things are starting getting tight, and he'd broken up with Ellen and headed back to Windsor, where his family was and where he grew up. And he was suffering from depression and alcohol issues. And I heard that, even for a while, he took a telemarketing job. And it was just so sort of in my head. I'm like, oh, God. You know, he's sort of hitting the rock bottom. Here's this guy who should have been, if everything was right in the world, this guy should have been a talk show star, a guy we'd be talking about today. And, within the last year, he's been doing telemarketing in Windsor. And in any case, he was found dead in his apartment. And there's speculation, oh, did he take his own life? But what seems to have come out of this is that they ruled it accidental. And I don't know much more in the way of details, but just a really, really devastating thing to see someone with such great potential just missing, just little forks in the road. That's what it is, I guess. Found out that when the Comedy Network first launched, and there's the Mike Bullard show, apparently it had come down to a decision between Eric Tunney and Mike Bullard, and they went with Mike Bullard. So you think of how, with that one decision, things might have gone a whole different way. I mean, it's really amazing and really sad. Eric was a great guy, and there's so many people who were touched by him and saddened, obviously, by his passing. And what I'm going to do the rest of this, I'm just going to play you. Hard to dig out. I'm surprised how little there is on YouTube, but I know that when I was down in Washington, on the HBO On Demand, I managed to find that Young Comedian special. So if you're in the States and you can try and find it, I believe it's the 95 Young Comedian special. In any case, I dug this audio up. There's video too. If you go to my website, I've linked to the video as well. But here's audio of a special that Eric did for the Comedy Network CTV here in Toronto.
Hey, everybody. We have a gay pride parade in Toronto, a now government-sanctioned gay pride parade, which one time it was not, and now it is government-sanctioned. I always wonder what the how this came to pass. I'm sure it was an advisor.
There's quite a few of them, sir. Maybe we should. They do vote as far as. Do we have them voting? Yes, we do.
Yes, I've now come out in favor of your parade. Though I personally won't be attending the parade, I have a sort of a pancake function I have to be at. But I wish you well with your parade and your floats, or do you call them something gayer? I'm not certain, but I wish you luck is what I'm saying. Send me the tape of it. I really wonder. I heard somebody say on the radio that a gay pride parade was obnoxious. Which I thought was a strange word anyway, obnoxious. And I thought, you know what would be really obnoxious? A heterosexual pride parade. Can you imagine the sleazy fellas hanging around this parade? Come here! Give me a kiss! Come on, it's a big celebration! Are you not proud, or? I don't drink a lot, but I do enjoy on occasion having, mostly a beer. Or I have a friend of mine who's really into wine. He knows a lot about wine. He's a wine connoisseur or maven, whatever the hell that means. I should look that up. A man who lies about his knowledge of wine is to be known as a maven. wine. It's funny, he collects wine, which is a funny thing to me, collecting wine. Now, if you had in your basement, let's say, 48 bottles of rum, wouldn't you just be a drunk? If it's wine, you are somehow, you know, with it. I always wonder why or how sometimes people drink certain drinks. You know, I think we're all familiar with, you know, beer and wine and of that ilk. But who drinks creme de menthe on purpose? Does anybody actually look forward to that drink? You know, I've been working hard all week. I'm having creme de menthe tonight. Oh, and I mean lots of it. I want to come home sticky. You've made a wise decision then. First time I had a drink in a lounge or a sort of a fancy bar, I was just of legal drinking age, and I wanted to not have the very typical beer. I thought I would have something a little more upscale or classy, which actually I love that word, classy. Classy. Usually people use that word to say stuff like, she's a classy broad, huh? Uh-huh. I love that as a response for yes, by the way. Uh-huh. There's no root of a word there at all. Uh-huh. And there's actually a negative, too. Uh-uh. We are closer to our cave cousins than we realize, I think. So I get into this bar, and the guy says, what do you have? And he actually said, what do you have? So I was thrilled. What do you have? And I said, you know what? I'll have a martini. I'll have a martini. And I didn't even know what was in one. So I asked one, and he said, you know, how do you want it? And I said, well, just make it the most traditional way. And so he got the fancy glass out, which I think is very appealing to most people. It's the universal sign of alcohol. If you're in an airport, there's no words, just that martini glass and an arrow, you know, booze this away. I mean, there's, hey, we got the hooch. I mean, that's, we're not kidding around. And he told me that martini is made with gin, plenty of gin, and a very small amount of dry vermouth, an Italian liquor, which is horrible. And the people that make it know it's horrible, too, because on the back of the bottle, there's all kinds of serving suggestions that you'd never in your life involve yourself with, you know. Have it with grapefruit juice at a brunch. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to that brunch. Rub it on your arm after a workout. Put it in the fridge in lieu of baking soda. We're having a thimble full in our lifetime. You better just accept you have a weak product. Now, when you have a martini, you want to have it dry. That's what they always tell you. And is there anything worse than that kind of humor? I'll have it dry humor. Oh, I'll have mine dry. Make mine dry. Make mine. Oh, I want it so dry that I will need a beverage after I have it. That is how dry and dry I am. I am one droll bastard, aren't I? Look at me. Oh, if only I could accept that I'm gay, but I cannot. It's a facade I must continue. The less vermouth, the drier the drink. The less vermouth, the drier the drink. So my thought was, why put any vermouth in at all? Would that not be ultimately dry at that point? But the problem is, it is no longer a martini. It is then a glass of gin. And there's a fine line between beverage connoisseur and hobo. This is sort of an old style suit. You know what I love about the old 40s and 50s suits is the fly is just tremendous. Is that not remarkable? Is that not unbelievable? What kind of clearance do they need You need that much room? I mean, who are you kidding? You know? Flipping like a flag on a pole. I mean, you know. It's funny when people compliment you in a way that they say that you look like somebody famous. And it's funny because you only want to say it if it's somebody, you know, of course, very attractive, complimentary, and also if they actually do look like that person. Because what I often want to say to people is, you know what, you look a lot like Paul Newman if everything in his life went wrong. If all his hopes and dreams hadn't come to fruition, you... You look like that guy. You look kind of like an alcoholic Paul Newman. That's what you look like. You know, Hitler. Hitler has pretty much put the kibosh on that mustache style. Have you noticed that? There is nobody wearing the Hitler mustache anymore. That guy ruined it for everybody. I had a strange indulgence the other day. I had a chicken pot pie, and not even a good one. I had like a 49-cent chicken pot pie. Should that be considered dinner? It should be more than the price of the paper to be. 49 cents. I have it in the oven, and it's cooking away, and I know it's cooking properly because that stuff is coming to the surface, that greeny, gray... Sauce? Gravy? What is it? Roux? I don't know what the technical term is. It's heading north. All right? So, and also, you know, I'm kidding myself that this is a convenience food. Doesn't it taste like, take like an hour and a half to cook this frozen piece of lard? How convenient is that, you know? Speckled trout is like 15 minutes in a fry pan. This is... So while it's cooking, I'm looking at the side panel, the ingredients. I'm curious to see what I'm about to ingest. And it starts fine. It's like peas and carrots and onions and flour. Mechanically separated chicken. Which, I don't know, that really conjures up an image in the factory, you know? Is that a necessary procedure? Or is that just for the amusement of the employees? The worst thing I've ever seen, chicken-wise, if that's actually a way to say something, the worst thing I've ever seen chicken-wise was in the like in the canned food section of a supermarket. One of those, you know, apple juice-sized cans, like a 48-ounce size can. The label said inside was a fully cooked... whole chicken. So I had to give that a shake. A very memorable sound. Just imagine that coming out of a can onto a plate. Big poultry splash all over. Now, they tell you why you want their product. That's always the way. On the label, it says it's good for picnics, after-school snacks. Wouldn't that be nice? You know? Kids! Oh, and their little eyes are just lighting up, you know? It's the chicken. It's the chicken, man, I told you. Kids are coming home. Mom, Billy's house has canned chicken. Well, we're not Billy's house. They're rich. My favorite is it's good for unexpected guests. Yeah. That'd get rid of them. Chicken comes out, you know, what the hell time is this? No, we have to go. We really are. No, let us go. I was listening to an old radio station before I came out here, and it was an AM radio station, and it was one of those music of your life, but not your life, like, you know, others who had more interesting wartime lives. People who conquered and did a lot of things and used leaded gas, those kind of lives. And the song was, you've heard the expression, here's mud in your eye? The song was, here's love in your eye. Isn't that a sweet song? Here's love in your eye. It's filthy, but it's sweet. AM radio. But I tend to listen to the oldie stations. That's what I enjoy. Because I love the ads for oldie shows. All the one-hit wonder bands that are continuing to tour because they are broke. They have some kind of, they had some horrible deal with their record label, and they're not even sure if they're allowed to do their own music. You know, that's how horrible the situation is. Are we even allowed to do our stuff, or what can we even? Well, it comes. Yes, you can do Blue Spanish Eyes. That's allowed. We don't do Blue Spanish Eyes. But you hear the ads, and you're suspicious of the originality as far as the members are concerned. When you hear the ad, you know, this week at Lulu's in Kitchener, it's Gary Puckett and the Union Gap. Only now, the drummer's the lead singer. The man who did no singing in the 60s at all now fronts the band. Come on down and try and decipher your favorite songs. But I do feel that I like a lot of different stuff. I mean, I grew up with, of course, rock and roll music and stuff. But I do enjoy some of the older standard stuff. I love Frank Sinatra, and I've actually had the pleasure of seeing him on a few occasions. The last of which was about 3 years ago at a place in Hamilton, Ontario, the Cops Coliseum, which I just love the fact it's called the Coliseum. I'm sure that's what the Romans had in mind, an orange-seated hockey rink. And some people said, oh, you're going to see Sinatra, and I'm sure that'll be great. I hear he's lost it, and that's, you know, he can't even, you know, remember the words or so forth, which, you know, he... was actually a lot better than you would imagine. He was actually quite good. He was very, lucid. I don't know. A lot of toasting, which I'm not sure if that was for our benefit or his. A lot of, and to good health. This one's to all the mothers. Oh, God bless the mothers. Did I mention your health at all? Did I? The health before this song, then. A few glitches in the show. You know, understandable. He's an 80-year-old man. Luck be a monkey tonight. Here's the worst part of the show. The opening act was unbelievable. The show business wafting off these people. Steve and Edie. Does that, you ever heard of them? Steve Lawrence? Oh, my. Oh. Just, especially Steve. Oh, with those giant chiclets looking at you. Huge. The insincerity is remarkable. It's actually commendable in some sick way, you know? And he loves dropping Frank's name, too, like we had no idea he knew him. You know, travels with him. You know, I was talking to Frank before the show, and then when Frank and I were having dinner, and, I said to Francis, Francis, he must know him. It's Francis! He has his wife on stage with him, Edie Gourmet. Wrap your head around that name. Edie Gourmet. It's not even her name. She changed it for show business. Her real name is... Virginia Heartthrob. Isn't that odd that you would change it to E.D.? He's so complimentary to her on stage. And I think he's complimentary in a very suspicious, guilty conscience, a little cheating in the 50s, there may be a book forthcoming type of politeness. Am I a lucky guy or what? A lot of that. Am I a lucky guy? And he's always laughing when nothing funny is going on. You know, like the way grandparents will do that when they see you. You know, Billy, how are you? Come on in. A mile. He says it a lot of times, too, because, you know, initially I don't want to judge this woman's appearance, you know, but he's begging me to with this am I a lucky guy or what nonsense, right? And you look over at Edie, and Edie's wearing this giant kimono. And you're just wondering what kind of physical hell is being concealed. Singing all your favorite songs, too. Clang, clang, clang goes the trolley. Ding, ding, ding. Oh, I paid $90 to see Sinatra, and I might leave. Unless that train comes into the station shortly. If you have the time, and it's not too crowded, it's actually quite a lot of fun to travel on a train. And I was on one very recently, about a four-hour train trip. And I had a young woman in front of me sitting with her daughter, maybe 5 years old, at that age anyway where you need a lot of attention. Child needs a lot of attention, you know. So she read a book to the child, and she read her The Little Engine That Could. Very clever. We're on a train. It's about a train, right? And I recall that story from my youth. I just don't remember it being that long and boring. Oh, my God, that story goes on forever. Will the engine make it? Could the engine make it? Make it, little engine. And of course it's going to make it. It's a child's book. You know? And then the engine blew up. Well, I got a book here about snakes biting children. Here we go. It's actually quite graphic. Look, the child's your age. I enjoy this city so much, Toronto. I really do. There's lots to enjoy. It is a big city, and there are reminders of people less fortunate than ourselves, which is some days when you're bitching about nothing in particular, it's quite annoying to see people that are worse off than you. You know, you're bitching about, the dry cleaner broke a button, and there's a guy with no head. You know? You're annoyed because you had a good bitch fest going on, right? You know? What are you doing here to ruin my complaining? Am I being worse off? And I'm not giving money to homeless people lately. And it's not because I'm not caring. It's this that I can pass 20 people on a 20-minute walk. And I can't give money to everybody. And I don't want to judge people as they approach me. You know, you can't go, no, you look like you caused your own misery. Oh, no, you're good and pathetic. Look at you. You look like hell. Here you go. Here you go. Here's my advice to you. Keep that sweater. That's your bread and butter. That sweater elicits sympathy. When these people approach me on the street, I would rather have them be caustic and angry. Because, for a couple of reasons. One, it makes sense. They live outside. They're all twitchy from the elements and whatever kind of booze substitute is coursing through their veins, namely household cleaners, which I honestly, how naive am I? I didn't believe that when I first read that report. Oh, come on, one guy. You know, I didn't believe it. And then my mind started to, you know, I put myself in their place, and it's so stupid, the things you think. You know, I think, oh, what would be my preference if I was on the street having solvents? Something lemony, I think I would have. Something like, Mr. Clean, I think, in fact, would be. And also, it alleviates my guilt if they're rude to me. That helps. You know, no, screw you. You know, that helps. Oh, I hate when they're polite and nice. You know, excuse me, sir, can you spare some change today? I'm sorry, not today. God bless you. It just sticks to the back of your neck for the rest of the day. You know? You did nothing for me, and I blessed you. Let's total it up. Zero, bless. Because I'm walking by with a $9 Häagen-Dazs bar. No, not today. That's tough for everybody, eh? You guys have been a wonderful crowd. Thanks a lot. We'll see you again. Yeah.